Just to give a visual demonstration of what I was talking about last time, I mentioned this newfangled idea of the fold-free batim of the shel rosh. So this is a classic shel rosh, where you see that there are a lot of folds. You have the four compartments were created with a wide piece of hide, and then they were smushed together. So you end up with a titura, this bottom piece over here again. Okay, so it's if you now your tefillin are painted nicely, so you can't see this at all. But you see, it's actually comprised of a lot of folds.
You put glue in there.
And then you put glue. So people don't like that. Some people don't like that, and they'd rather be this way that was invented by an engineer actually, living in Telstone. So he figured out a way to do it, still maintaining the one solid piece of leather here in the titura. And there are some people that like that better. And again, this is also the fold that we were talking about when it closes over here and you sew it. So this is the crack over here. Although hopefully on yours looks nice. So that everybody asked me about that. They're all concerned about it opening up and seeing a crack, but I prefer to be able to see the crack.
What do these exactly to close in this? Farther one, like that one.
This?
Close it up and they give you the tefillin.
Yeah, they glue all this together.
Oh, the top part, like the top four compartments.
Oh, this was talking about the four compartments being prudis. They're separate.
But no one has tefillin that looks like that, right? That's actually...
Well, there are, yeah. There are people. I mean, it's a whole shayla of how you measure the ribua of the tefillin. So some shittas hold, the Brisker Rav held like this, but this is the Pashtus and earlier shittas as well. That the ribua is measured when you press the four compartments together. So it doesn't matter how far they open up.
So you could have like the wing.
Yeah, the Chassam Sofer held that the ribua is measured the way they are now. So that's why the Chassam Sofer actually held that it was better to put a little glue if there was any chance that it would open up. So there are the batimachers nowadays have found a way that it maintains the ribua even the way it is and it doesn't open up without putting any glue. But if it does open up a little bit, so according to the vast majority of sheets, it's really not a problem. And some people prefer actually to be able to see a little space in between because they feel that it's not really called parud unless you could see space in between. Again, most people's tefillin, even when they have the space, is not as extreme as this because this isn't a finished bias. They would still press it together a little bit more before you actually give it to the customer. Okay, finished with batims. Now we go on to ritzuis. Different brands of ritzuas, different heksherim. Also, the main part about the ritzuas should come from a kosher animal, so I don't think there have been any scandals about ritzuas coming from non-kosher animals. But there are different standards of being made lishma, bavodas yad, and there are more issues nowadays with the paint. That you have issues that the paint either comes off, it could be peeled off in a layer, or some people don't like that they put like a layer of clear plastic over the black paint. Rabbi Leibowitz had one of his 10-minute halachas recently about that, if you want to go listen. I haven't quite gotten to the bottom of this issue yet, but some people feel there's a problem with a lot of the ritzuas on the market, but it's still being determined. A question that you'll get from Balabatan probably is whether they should get the black on black or the black and white ritzuas, meaning if it just painted black on top, or if the whole ritzua, the whole skin before they paint it with a nice shiny paint on top, is soaked in black dye, so it's completely black through and through. So the maila of the black on black ritzuis is that since there is halacha moshe misinai, the ritzuis always has to remain black. So even if some of the nice shiny paint comes off, so it still be black because underneath is black also. That's assuming, like, of course, like the shita, you don't go by rove for this. That so many people read the Mishnah Berurah as saying that every single spot on the ritzua has to be black, so that violates halacha moshe misinai, the ritzua has to be black. Rav Yosef Chaim Zonnefeld held that you do go by rov, as long as the ritzua, basically, if you look at it, gives the impression of being black, you call this a shvarza ritzua, you know, black ritzua, so then that would be sufficient. But if you want to be machmer, like the machmer reading of the Mishnah Berurah, so people prefer the black on black ritzuas. So Rav Yosef, as well known, was a very conservative figure in halacha in general, so he felt that you should not do the black-on-black ritzuas because, he says, okay, if you come up with a new chumra that nowadays it's easy to do, and in all the generations that it was very, very hard to do. Like nowadays, okay, you want to be makbid on glatt kosher meat because there's tons and tons of meat that you can get by walking the store and buy glatt kosher meat. So you want to be makbid on glatt, fine. So because it was very hard in the olden days when they had a higher, and they meat was much more expensive, etc. But he said here, it's no newfangled technology. You always have black dye. You could have dyed the ritzuas black or painted it black on all the sides. But nevertheless, you see they didn't do it. So you see, the Mesoira is that you only have black on one side. Even though the Rambam holds that Lechatchila, even though the Halacha Moshmi Sinai only goes on the outer part of the Ritzua, Lechatchila, the Ritzua should be black on all the sides. So nevertheless, he feels that the Mesoira is against the Rambam, and we should go only black on one. Not as far as I recall. No, I mean, nobody holds that it's a puzzle to do black on and black on all the sides.
He says v'cheino again regarding having.
It could be. He says something like that, but it doesn't. He doesn't go stark that Dafka don't do it because there's something bad about it.
Oh no. Okay.
So that's again, there are different approaches to that. They're both seem to be pretty legitimate. Another issue regarding tefillin is whether you wrap in or out. So that's, halachically speaking, there's no difference whether you wrap the tefillin this way or wrap the tefillin this way. There are some poskim who have a preference for the way the knot is constructed for people who wrap in. So generally speaking, unless you have a strong minhag towards the other way, so it's better to do what you call wrapping in for regular Ashkenazim, where that's a mekubal thing to do. Teimanim actually have the Ashkenazi knot for wrapping in, but they wrap the other way. They turn it around to wrap the other way. So that's just something to keep in mind. Another issue is the tzura of the knot of the shel rosh, which is one of my favorite topics. That the way the knot of the shel rosh looks. So we know that there are two main ways to do it, although there are other ways to do it. I'll pick up all, but the two main ways that are noag nowadays in Klal Yisrael is the what you call the square knot, the plain box, and the knot that looks like this. You know. The one that looks more like a dalet. So Rav Soloveitchik, famously in this yeshiva, used to tell people that if their minag was to do the square knot, they had to switch to the dalet knot, because nu, it says in the Gemara, and the Rishonim, that the knot of the tefillin shel rosh has to look like a dalet. So this looks like a dalet, that doesn't look like a dalet, so it must be that the other one is wrong. So he used to tell people that they had to change their minag. It was famously one of the few issues where Rav Soloveitchik used to tell people they had to change their minag. The only problem is that's not really correct, because if you follow there were several Rishonim brought in the Beis Yosef and Siman Lamed Beis and other places as well, where the Rishonim give step-by-step instructions on how to make the knot of the Tefillin Shel Rosh, and in every single one of them, without exception, it comes out the plain box, the plain square knot. So as Rabbanim, again, you're not Yotzi, I can't say you're not Yotzi with a dalet knot, but certainly, as Rabbanim, it's a very, very, very bad idea to tell your Balabatim to switch from the square knot to the dalet knot. To give the teretz how it looks like a dalet, many people give different terutzim. There's a whole fat sefer written on it recently called Pri Eliezer, but it's not his chiddush. Other people pointed this out before, that really it's pretty clear that the original kesher was the square knot, and that in fact was nog in all of Klal Yisrael, Ashkenazim, Sfardim, Teimanim, until just a few hundred years ago. Putting on tefillin of Rabbeinu Tam. So we know there's a pious practice to put on tefillin of Rabbeinu Tam, which is why. There are many different machloksim in Hilchos tefillin. So what's pshat? We're just choshish for Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam. So Nodeb Yehuda has a tshuva where he points out that the reason that we specifically singled out the quote-unquote shita of Rabbeinu Tam for people to be choshish for and not the other shitas is because if you look at the Rishonim, it's not machlokas between Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam. Yes, it is, but it didn't originate with them and it didn't end with them. It's almost a 50-50 machlokas between the Rishonim as to whether the halacha follows Rashi or whether it follows Rabbeinu Tam. So therefore, that's why it's an accepted midas chasidus in many communities to put on Rabbeinu Tam. Different communities, Alpi Kabbalah, there's a very big inyan to put on Rabbeinu Tam. So that's why in communities that are more focused on Kabbalah, Sfardim, Chasidim, they are generally more public about putting Rabbeinu Tam, whereas Ashkenazim, who put on Rabbeinu Tam tefillin, generally put them on privately, or at least more surreptitiously after davening, as opposed to making a thing out of putting Rabbeinu Tam. Again, I don't know if any of your Balabatim will be on this level that they're going to be asking you to put on Rabbeinu Tam, at least if they're a regular Ashkenazim. But it's just it's something as well that one should keep in mind.
What's the Iker Machlok is about?
According to Rashi, that the parshiyas go like this: Kadesh Vayakiv Yacha Shema Vayayim Shamoa. And according to Rabbeinu Tam, you switch the order of these two. That it's Vayayim Shamoa and Shema.
And that's Ma'akiv, according to.
Yeah. The Gemara says Hechlif parshiyas and Psulos. That if you put the parshiyas in the wrong order, so that's no good. It's a further machlokes within the so-called Shita Rabbeinu Tam, it's used to have a lot of Rishonim and Megionim, not just Rabbeinu Tam, whether it applies only to the Tefillin Shel Rosh or also to the Tefillin Shel Yad. So according to a lot of Rishonim, it applies only to the Tefillin Shel Rosh. So that makes, you know, you could spend half as much money if you want to buy a B'makbet put on Rabbeinu Tam. But the general minhag is that people who put on Rabbeinu Tam do a different Shel Yad as well as a different Shel Rosh. In terms of buying mezuzahs, so one thing that's important to tell Baal HaBatim when buying mezuzahs is please don't buy the case and then try to squeeze the mezuzah in afterwards. That's a really bad idea. People come in with these tiny cases. What can you sell me that will fit in this this tiny case? So basically, there are generally two options if you want a mezuzah that small. Either really cheap or really expensive, because if it's written poorly, which is most mezuzahs that size are, so then they're going to be really cheap and questionably kosher. Or if you want a gorgeous mezuzah that's written that size, so you're going to pay dearly for it. Again, it can be done. If you pay $100, $150, you can get a mezuzah this this small. That's mehudar according to L'chol HaDeis. But it's very rare, so therefore, buy a good scroll and then put in, again, then get a case that fits the scroll as opposed to vice versa. There is Shaila. That actually is in many buildings in the Heights, that the Pashas in Halacha is that an apartment building that's mostly inhabited by Jews require a mezuzah on the front door. So Reb David Feinstein has a kula why maybe it's not required, but that is the Pashta. So that's why in Eretz Yisrael especially, or in places where the Jews have more control or they won't have people ripping down the mezuzah, so it's should tell people that they should get a mezuzah on the front door of the building as well, as long as the building is mostly inhabited by Jews. And again, so then you get into the shell of which minag the mezuzah should follow, which ksav. So if you ask me, I don't really care, but some people are very makbid, as we pointed out last time, on the ksav. So in general, unless there's a clear majority of a certain type of group that lives in the building, so generally, Poskim would recommend to do ksav Beis Yosef, which is supposedly all Shita should accept. After all, Beis Yosef was a Sephardi, so Sephardim, even though they don't use Ksav Beis Yosef, should be okay with Ksav Beis Yosef. History is actually a bit more complicated, because the Beis Yosef, when he's telling you how to make the letter, is actually quoting an Ashkenazi Sefer on how to make the Tzuras Osios, but that's a normal Shita. In terms of purchases for your shul, so one thing that's nice to get for a shul, if you have enough money, instead of renovating the social hall, unless you get a lot more members and I get more money, so it might be worth it in the long run. But I don't know, what's a frivolous expense that shuls have? What's a frivolous expense that shuls collect money for something that's not halachically necessary or really part of kavod basic nesses?
Mezuzahs. I'm not
following.
Like, what does shuls spend money on? Like extra food at the kiddush kind of?
Something like that.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so you could put a less expensive cut of meat in the cholin and save up for what's called the sifra daftarta, which is a gewaltig gazach, which a lot of shuls do not have nowadays, which is what the Gemara says. You're supposed to, maybe not l'chatchila, but the Gemara certainly endorses the recitation of haftaras from a sifra daftarta, which is all the haftaras written on a klaf, and lest you think that this will severely limit the pool of people who can say the Haftorah, you can actually put Nekudos and Trop in a Sifra Daftarta. So it's a good idea to get a Sifra Daftarta if you can afford it.
How much does it cost?
I never actually...
more than a cut of meat.
No, that's Nevi'im. That's full Nevi'im.
For a full year, I mean...
Oh, great. So
full Nevi'im is... A full set of Nevi'im is about 2 Sifra Torah. So yeah, most shuls are not holding by. Most shuls are not holding by full sets of Nevi'im. That's mostly yeshivas have sets of Nevi'im following the Vilna Gaon. But Sifra Daftarta is good enough for most shuls and is much, much better al pidin than reciting the Haftarah from a printed Sefer. Probably, Sifra Daftarta is probably maybe in the low tens of thousands. As opposed to the Sefer Torah, which is could be 50, 60, 70,000.
It's all
in the VM? It's the Haftorahs. It's just Haftorahs written on klaf.
Not what they have here. Here they have
the full Nevi'im. So that's what the Gemara sounds like. Really, you should learn the Haftorah from a full Navi. But the Gemara says, Eis Lassos, you can use a Sifra Daftarta. But at least that you don't get into the Shaila for sure of reciting the Haftorah Baal Peh, which is what you basically are doing if you write it from a Chumash, because a Chumash, as printed nowadays, is surely not considered written. al pi halacha.
It's the if you, are you able to put the nekudos into the full seven nevi'im or no?
That lechora you don't have much to lose because we know by a sefer Torah it's puzzle, so you put it into nevi'im. So the worst comes to worst, you're leaning from puzzle nevi'im, which is no worse than a sefer daftarta. Whether it's a kosher, what?
Then you're 100,000.
Yeah, whether it's a kosher navi scroll, maybe not, but. The Emek Bracha talks about if you apply the halachis of Megillas Esther, which is kosher with Nikudis, to other Navi scrolls. He's not so sure what the answer is. Regarding Megillas Esther, so it's also a good idea to make sure that your shul has a kosher Megillas Esther, that you might have a really old one that's in very bad condition. It might be kosher al pi din, because we know that all the just rove has to be there in order to be considered kosher, but. It's a good idea to invest in a nice Megillas Esther, a hiddur of which is not having Hamelech at the top of each column. Some people think that there's some Inyan, I don't know why, to have Hamelech at the top of each column. There's no such Inyan al pi halacha at all. Better to make sure that the Megillah is written properly. Some people, in order to attempt to be Yotzei both the Minag and the Shita of the Gra, according to how the Aseres B'nei Haman should be written. So the minag is that you write them to take up an entire column, which might mean making them bigger, and the Gros says, no, they don't have to be a separate column. They just need to be written like a Shira, maybe within the column, maybe the Gros, they're supposed to be at the bottom of the column for some reason. But whatever it is, so in order to be Yotzei both, that you shouldn't have to write them big, and that they should be Yotzei the minag, take up the same column. So some people came up with this kunz to write the Megillah in 11 lines. So some people say, great, that's wonderful, Yotzi, all the Shitas, that's a great idea. I personally find it way too sticky, and I think that there might be other problems with this, so I don't personally recommend the 11-line Megillahs, but again, that'll be up to your rabbinical discretion.
So it's pretty impractical if you're like going to a hospital to lay, and you have to, every time. So it's like
that's only Betzibur, that you have to fold it.
It's very impractical. If you're going someplace,
okay. Good. So don't get one.
I'm totally ignorant. 11 lines opposed to.
Because that's the number of Aseres B'nei Haman plus one line for Ish at the top. The word Ish.
What is it usually?
Usually, a Megillah is written in either 21, 28, or sometimes the same height as a Sefer Torah, 42 or 48 columns. Now that you mentioned that, by the way, so that's another thing, that the normal tikkun of a Sefer Torah nowadays is that each column has 42 lines, which is, I think, a Masechet Sofrim says the minimum number of lines per column is. But the problem is, the Rambam and others hold that the minimum number of lines in a column is 48. So the question is, the Masechet Sofrim never said that you dafka have to have 42 lines per column, and you're welcome to do more, so then you have a Sefer Torah that has too few lines, not Makib B'dieved, but according to you have too few lines according to the Rambam, and not only that, but it makes Sefer Torah heavier, because you have to use more klaf when you make the column shorter, so it's better to make the columns of 48 lines, or maybe even more. You have make it easier for people to do Hagba, you use perhaps make it a little bit less expensive, there are other advantages too, of using a Sefer Torah with more than 42 lines.
Do people do that, or generally not?
It's becoming more popular nowadays. There is this standard tikkun that became, the be-all and end-all that all Sifrei Torah, not all, but the vast majority of Sifrei Torah that have been written in the last 50 years follow, which makes it easier for Bali Kriya, but then that follows the 42 lines. But there's absolutely no reason, al pi din, that you have to follow that tikkun. My shul just got a new Sifrei Torah a couple years ago. And so I told them I arranged for it. I told Sofer exactly what to do. But I made it 48 lines. So maintaining Sifrei Torah, besides purchasing new stamps, so when you're maintaining Sifrei Torah is a big issue because of what I told you about last time with the ink that rusts. So the ink tends to turn brown and red, assuming it's made with the normal type of ink that's been used for the last couple hundred years. So then you have an issue. And also, this ink is also much more brittle. It's more prone to cracks in the letters, flaking. So it's depending on the condition, sometimes it doesn't pay to fix, and it's better if you have a shul with the means, so it's better to raise the money, buy a new Sefer Torah, use one of the new inks that doesn't turn red and it doesn't flake, and you'll save on maintenance costs in the long run. Sometimes the Rabbanim will try to repair the Sefer Torah themselves. So I show you the pen. So this pen, I told you the pen last time, right? That this pen is supposedly doesn't have any non-kosher ingredients. It's not official dyo, but anyway, the ink that we use nowadays is not is following the shita that anything black is kosher, and isn't they don't have to actually follow the recipe of dyo from the Gemara. So therefore, some people use this type of pen or other types of black pens to repair the Sefer Torah if it's just a minor repair and you don't want to bring in a sofer to fix the Sefer Torah. But obviously, this has its limits. You should have in mind that all the writing has to be done lishma. Again, b'diavad, even if you didn't say lishma, and you fix something in a Sefer Torah, so it would be kosher b'diavad, because once the Sefer Torah is already written and you're fixing a Sefer Torah, so it's obviously you're doing lishma. So you say stama lishma in such a situation, but you should lechatchila say l'shem kedusha Sefer Torah before you write. But again, if there's any shayla or anything that requires erasing, we get into problems of chaktocho, so it's unless you know the halachas very well, so you should call in a trained sofer to perform the correction. Also for Seamus, if you're fixing up some, touching up something on a Shem, so it's not there, it's there, you have to say, not only Shem Kedusha Sefer Torah, but Shem Kedusha Hashem as well. That has an additional level of lishma that's required. Something that frequently comes up with older Sefer Torah is you have stitches that are ripped. So the gidim are ripped, so you it's a very simple stitch, so in theory you could learn how to do it yourself, but normally you're calling a sofer to fix the Sefer Torah, but the Sefer Torah is kosher as long as most of the urea is sewn, but lechatchila the entire urea should be sewn, so therefore you should get it fixed as soon as possible.
Rabbi Ben Chaim likes to say how when he was in Iran,
yeah,
he went walking to shul one day and he sees the Sefer Torah is like it's been stitched with some like string,
yeah.
And he asked the
rabbi,
he's like, what is this?
He's
like, yeah, I found a mistake.
So
it's not.
Fixed
it myself.
Oy. Okay.
Maybe it was in one of the rabbis in Iran. I forgot. You can ask him. But,
okay. So
people don't have that. You have to have gidim.
Has to be with gidim, right?
Right. Has to be with gidim.
What if roll over a gidim and then get part of it?
Kasher b'dieved. Yeah, most of the rear stone would gidim, so that's not, it's not worse than if it wasn't the stitch, other stitches weren't there at all. The entire area should be sewn with gidim, which could be procured at your local sofer supply stores, which are generally in Brooklyn, but it's not a bad idea to keep some gidim on hand. There have been scandals with gidim being made out of pig sinews, so we have to make sure that your gidim come from a reputable source. People should also understand
what
no, maybe it's cheaper. Maybe somebody gave it them for free, so they made the gidim out of it.
Okay.
Money. Everything's about money. So yeah, but definitely get the gidim from a reputable source, and you'll avoid these problems. Some things that you'll see in older Sefer Torah are not problems, but don't necessarily correspond to how it's done nowadays in terms of the writing of the letters. So generally, it's best to not get too worked up, and if it's something that was an accepted minhag in Klal Yisrael, even if it's not the way it's accepted nowadays, so I would leave it as it is. And many old ksavim, and old Ashkenazi ksav, for example, the shin was round. And in an old Sephardi ksav, the shin had the shin had a flat base. So this seems, again, I'm not going to also get now, but it seems maybe to contradict the Gemara that the shin needs to end in a point. So sometimes we'll find old Sefer Torah where the shin looks like that, or other letters are not written in the manner that that the Mishnah Berurah says, for example. So you should keep it. If it's an old minhag, it's unless it was total amaratzis, which is possible. It was written by a sofer that was totally not qualified. Sometimes in Sefer Torah, everything looks perfect, but experts can identify actually the Sefer Torah as is well known in Lithuania around the in the before World War I, maybe between the two World Wars. There was a whole industry of puzzle Sefer Torah that were being exported to America. So if you can pinpoint the Sefer Torah from this time period, even if it looks perfect, so Meishel had that before my time. I remember the previous rabbi told me that they had to get rid of one of their Sefer Torah because they were told by an expert that this was for sure one of the Svarim that are written as is well known by Mechalei Shabbos, by women, by different people who are not qualified to write Sefer Torah. and created major problems. When you encounter a problem with a Sefer Torah in the middle of laning, so the basic principle is that there is a Sfek Sfeika you could rely on, because the Rambam famously says in a tshuva that you could lane out of a puzzle Sefer Torah, and maybe there's a machlokas about this letter, whether it's kosher or not kosher. So then it's a Sfek Sfeika. Maybe the late letter is kosher, and even if it's not kosher, so then maybe we can rely on the Rambam who holds that you can lane out of a puzzle Sefer Torah. What? You're talking about a shelas tinok.
Let's say you just have no idea. You don't know anything about Kassam, and if someone says there's a mistake, you don't. That's not necessarily a suffix, because you could ask someone like you who knows. No.
If yeah, yes.
Not really a suffix.
Well, sometimes it's a legitimate suffix as a machlokas aposkim.
Okay.
And also, if it's a shel about the tsura of the letter per se, then you have what's called a shelas tinok. Shelastino, the Gemara says that the way you determine whether a letter is kosher or not kosher is you take a child who... It doesn't say it's explicitly the Gemara, but this is the accepted approach. You have to take a child who knows the letters but cannot read words fluently. And he or she can look at the letter and determine whether it's and read it. You say, what's this letter? Good idea to test the child to make sure that that he can recognize the other letter. Say, what's this letter? What's this letter? What's this letter? And then you point to the letter that you want to make sure that the kid just, you know, is not totally making things up over here. And then if the kid says okay, so then the letter would be would generally be okay. So we're talking about a child in first grade, second grade. Something like that. Some people think it's under bar mitzvah. Some people take an 11-year-old or 12-year-old kid, they make a shalas tinok. That's really not not correct. Some people say that in such a situation, you could make a shalas tinok if you cover up all the other letters, so he doesn't have any context to read from. But better to use a regular shalas tinok.
And that's what is the shalas tinok clarifying? It's clarifying if it's a suffix.
No, it's clarifying. No, if the child reads a letter correctly, it's kosher. No more suffix. It says in the Gemara explicitly. Yeah. So in a Sefer Torah, if a letter looks off, so it can always be fixed. So the Shaila comes up more in Tefillin and Mezuzis that you have the problem of Shaloka Sidron. You can't go back and fix letters that then unless if they're really illegible. So if then a Shaila's dinner comes more into play, but in a Sefer Torah comes to play more on Shabbos when you can't fix the Sefer Torah. So sometimes you mask a Shaila's Tinok on Shabbos to make sure that you can continue laning from this Sefer Torah. So the Gemara says that the tinok has to be delo chakim velo tipesh. It can't be too smart, can't be too dumb. So should be regular. Most kids we assume fall under this category. I heard a story. A sofer told me once. He asked the mezuzah to a child of this age, and the shaila was that the word vishinantam, the mem at the end was a little rounded. So he thought maybe, his over thought maybe it looked like a samech, so maybe he was going to pass the mezuzah. So he went to a kid and he said, what's this letter? So the kid said, mem. So the sofer asked the kid, how'd you know it was a mem? The kid says, there's no samech in Parsha Shema.
Overqualified.
So that's called the tinok chacham. That's such a tinok is not not kosher for a shailas tinok. He's too smart.
I never thought about this before. Supposed to show them the whole
word?
Most kids will know that.
Where does
that's a word.
Not in, I don't know. We're not in first grade, no.
Yeah, my son knows. Yeah, my son.
Okay.
He's a chacham then. He can't ask him.
No, they would know, no?
Okay. Maybe. But the point is, yeah, you shouldn't.
I mean, my son's right, but yeah, like. Yeah,
the Gemara sure. Explicitly says that you show them the whole word, but there are minhagim later that you cover some of the letters. You cover the letters before, so we can't go by. Yeah, so if you cover it, then you have more room to be mekal. Yeah.
That's a pasuk that like the kids sing from the, you know, the time they turn two, they're singing that.
Yeah, pasuk. But they'll see it in a mezuzah and to realize at the end of the line, I don't know.
That word in particular.
You stop everything and you bring in a kid. That's how you do it?
That's on Shabbos. That's the way to do it.
You're reading and then you come later.
No, the best way to do it is you do it on the spot. So you know whether to put back the Sefer Torah or not. So you put back the Sefer Torah generally only when a letter is vadai pasul. there's certain things that al pi halacha that we assume that it's possible, even if the kid could realize it. Like the normative halacha is that if the regal of the kuf, for example, is touching the roof of the kuf, so it looks like this connected. So there are rishonim that are machshir that, but we assume that's possible. Although some people would say that's also a sfek sveika, because there are, let's say, the Rambam and then the Iri don't hold from these things where there are specific halachas of how each letter should look. They say the letter is legible, it's legible. So the Rambam and the Meiri would presumably hold that a kuf that looks like this with the connected regal is kosher. So therefore, you would not have to take out a new Sefer Torah in this situation, because you could also say Sfek Sveika because of that. Okay, I have here a lot of... I'm not going to discuss each individual letter because we don't have time.
So when would be a case when you would vadai put it back? Like
if a letter... two letters are touching, that's vadai puzzle. So you have to put back the Sefer Torah. Or if the letter...
It's a common mistake that people would...
Touching. Spacing problems. If, for example, a word... The sofer left too much space between the letters of the same word and it looks clearly like two words. That would also be a vadai psul. So there's a vadai psul, so then you put it back. If there's a suffix psul, so you could rely on the svek sveka.
I've seen, in the shul, there's a child of the rabbi, takes his finger and starts,
probably what that is making sure it's not just some dirt on top of the letter. That happens pretty frequently, actually. Valkorik calls me over, huh?
If they're touching, it's really dirt.
Sometimes it could be a little dirt, or sometimes the letter looks misshapen or covered over. So that happens. That happens a few times. Valkorik calls me over. It's perhaps all in the Sefer Torah, and it's really just dust on top of it. So that's...
If it's stuck, is it a Shabbos issue?
If it's stuck on, maybe. Yes, but it's also a stam issue.
Right.
That it could be that if it's mamish stuck on, so the letter isn't considered legible, so then it's a problem. I think Rav Avadia has a shul about this. Like the wax dripping on top of the Sefer Torah. If the wax is clear, I think so.
And, sorry to keep...
No, it's fine, it's fine.
So people have this thing, they don't touch the cloth. So,
yeah,
if you're fixing,
Sofrim can't be too religious, that's the call. Sometimes you have to have compromise in order to fix it. So for the covet of the Sefer Torah, so then you have to touch the cloth sometimes.
You want your hand
before it? Yeah. So some poskim hold that the whole prohibition of touching a Sefer Torah with bare hands is only if you don't wash them beforehand. So it saves you a little bit if you wash before.
What's the other reason not to touch it?
Us covet.
It's not us covet.
What?
It's puzzles.
If the Sefer Torah, I don't know, still not the Chavadik, maybe. But yeah, Nechanami.
When you
stop
writing,
it's not a Sefer Torah yet.
Right.
Yeah, Nechanami.
That's why you're saying Tikkunim.
Of course, the other Pshat, it's Tikkunim, so then it could be Kosher Mekardin, yes. Yep. The other Pshat is Sefer, it was called Ochiz B'Sefer Torah, doesn't mean that you touch it without gloves. It means you hold it while not wearing any clothes, which is more of a Bizayon. So it's a different Pshat than what it means, Ochiz B'Sefer Torah. Maintenance. That's maintenance of Sefer Torah. And now maintenance of tefillin. So one thing we talked about was the squareness. So the rule is by ribua of tefillin. So there are a few parts that have to be square. The tefiris, the stitching here has to be, that goes around, has to be in the form of a square. The titura, this base part, has to be square, which obviously isn't, it's becoming square. This bias is still in the beginning stages of being manufactured. It will probably never finish its journey to being manufactured. So the...
How would you finish it?
You have to
cut?
No, you soak it in water. Uh-huh. Well, you do it. You have to cut this part, yes.
Okay.
And take off this hair. Okay. You would have to... Then you soak it in water. It becomes pliable. You fold it over. And then you cut.
Okay.
That's basically how you do it. So people have issues sometimes with the squareness of their tefillin. I remember when I was on NCSY Kollel after 11th grade, I think. They brought in a sofer to give a presentation. So he was talking about the ribua of tefillin. So everybody got all nervous. They started bringing over their tefillin. He had a caliper, a piece of equipment that measures digitally, or does not do digital, down to the fractions of a millimeter. you know, this, I don't know, yours is half a millimeter off. So the pashtus is that that's way too far. The pashtus is that it looks, if it looks square, it's square. It goes by just like anything else in the Torah. Not that we don't learn in the Torah Malachi Ashari is that if it looks square, it's square. You don't have to use these precise instruments of measuring in order to assess the squareness. So every Rav should be qualified to pass in the Shaila by himself without resorting to precise measuring tools. People come also with issues at the corners of the batim get banged in. So they're worried that it doesn't look square anymore because the corners aren't perfectly sharp. So I always tell them that Moshe Rabbeinu's tefillin also probably did not have perfectly sharp corners. But people are nervous about it. So then that there's a very easy way to fix that. So you could probably do it yourself or instruct the Balabas to do it himself, although they might not want to. Is you take a Q-tip and you wet the Q-tip and you lean it against the corner of the bias, and that makes the hide puff up and fills in the pigima where it got sanded down or bumped in. So then you take sandpaper and then you make it into a nice corner. Very easy. Literally, you don't have to be a sofer to do it.
Like, instantly, or like you have to leave it there for a little
while? You leave it for a few hours, Chris. Yeah. Anyway, but usually it's not necessary. Usually when people come to me with bumps on their tefillin, so usually I tell them it's really not necessary. I think in the around yeshiva, once somebody's tefiris were really clearly not square, so I told them to get them redone. But usually, almost every time somebody comes with nervousness about whether tefillin are really merubah, it's not an issue. The ribua also only goes on the length and width. It does not go on the height. So the batim can be as tall as you want, as long as they're rectangular. They could be, you know, what's called a cylinder. Not the right geometric term. So the they could be really tall. This happens more in the Shelyad. But that they're manufactured lechatchila to be a little bit taller. So that's something sometimes is done lechatchila even. That's also done in order to be able to stick the parshias all the way into the bias. That there's somewhat of a shaila that you see here, if you look at the bottom here. So the compartments into which you could stick the parshias go from here, the titura, all the way into this part, the ktsitsa. So some poskim prefer, it's not clear this is really really correct, but that the parshias go all the way only into here. They shouldn't extend down into the titura. So Basha says you don't need that, and even Rav Avadia, who's the famous, who supposedly the famous holder of this shita, more information is coming to light that even he did not hold that was necessary. But that's the reason that people make a tall shel yad, especially because they want the parsha to fit entirely within the ktsitsa and not within the titura. Also, it helps a little bit with the positioning of things if you want to make the shel yad smaller. But it really is something that maybe Rabbanim could encourage the consumers to fix, is tefillin are too big most of the time. They're just too big. You don't need them to be so large. And
too big halakhically, like what, practically?
No, practically.
For the spot.
So, for example, right. So the for a bar mitzvah boy, especially one who's on the smaller size, so the a regular size shel yad is really too big. It's unwieldy.
What's the reason Chabad has such big
body? The reason Chabad has such big tefillin is because the shimusha rabba, which is a something that comes from the Geonim, the early Geonim. Regarding it's a guide of how to make tefillin. When he describes a tefillin, he describes that it should be two etzbos by two etzbos. So the normative understanding, first of all, the Shulchan Aruch, most poskim hold, there is no shear for the tefillin at all. But even if you want to go with a two etzbos shear, the pashas is that it goes by the titura. That also counts towards the two etzbos. But the Chabad holds that it goes by the batim only, and they want chazanish shearim. So they want it to be, the batim themselves to be two chazanish. In Europe, that was the minhag, actually. Not regarding the volume measurements, that by the revius and the...
Right.
The parshias are actually nicer a lot of times in really old tefillin. There was a time when, you know, as far as maybe they weren't, but if you get from communities where they're really makbid, on these things, that a lot of times the tefillin were, the parashas were nicer because they were enormous. It's like writing a Sefer Torah and sticking it in a bias. Yeah.
My business, you said that the smaller it is, like the very, very expensive, so which tefillin is the same thing, the smaller it is.
Yeah, so some people, you look around, some people have tiny tefillin. So the reason people want to do that most of the time is because they want to do like, I could say the Ari, but it's really the Rosh. Possibly earlier, they want to put on Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam at the same time, not one after the other. So they make two small tefillin to make sure they both fit in the proper place. So they make them really, really small. Some people get really small tefillin because they find them more comfortable, or because they want to wear tefillin all day, or different, different types of.
Would they normally be much more expensive because then the parchment has to be much smaller?
If you want to get small tefillin that are as nice as larger tefillin, then yes, you pay more money. How much?
2,000?
I mean, there's a huge range. A nice small tefillin, they could be 2,000, yeah. It could be more.
Like, would it be base level 1,500 or whatever you said last year?
You probably could get for 1,500, maybe even cheaper, but they wouldn't be necessarily so nice. Again, prices are so... they fluctuate.
A lot of people get small ones. Some people wear both at the same time.
Some if you don't wear at the same time, why do you need such small ones unless you're wearing them all day?
The guys here wear them all day.
Really? Okay. Yeah. They're successful at being master their...
They're
inspired
in the trash. Because the block is too loud for
them. Okay. Okay.
So, yeah, we can cut you off. You were saying just that was your only point, that, that smaller is better because it practically fits on.
Oh, so it doesn't have to be that small, like the ones people who wear two. Uh-huh. Those are called pitzponim, is the technical Safra's term for them. It's used nowadays. But... for a bar mitzvah boy, really, the parents should order a small shelyad. There's no reason. I mean, it'll last him forever. You don't need a huge shelyad. They make it a little smaller. It'll fit better on the even if you're not makbid on the what the Shulchan Aruch seems to quote from the smak, which is a huge chiddush that the sefer that the tefillin have to fit on the lower half of the bone, which is under the bicep. So most Rishonim hold you have the whole bicep, 99.5% of Rishonim hold, you have the entire bicep to put on the tefillin. So even if you're going to rely on that shita, even so, it's too big. It's going to drape off the sides of his arm. It's just not necessary. It's too, way too unwieldy. So it makes it hard to put on, hard to tie. So try to convince people to get smaller. And you can make the titura smaller, you can make the bias a little smaller without compromising on the quality of the parshias. So if you have influence, so tell the parents of boys who are becoming bar mitzvah that they should get small shel rosh. Get a small, little smaller shel. I mean, sorry, smaller shel yad. You get a smaller shel rosh also. Yeah, and maybe not as small as the shel yad, but there's no reason that again shel rosh is also too big most of the time to fit properly. I mean, maybe halachically it might, but it's also unwieldy.
That's all for them. The whole cloth
defends the makom. That's what the Mishnah Berurah says. Mishnah Berurah shreis about people who have a little bit of their tefillin coming below the hairline or former hairline. So wherever the makom shel tinok rofes. So that
you see like a dolan picture, it's like it's like hanging off, like
not a middle saying shema.
What?
They're not a middle saying shema.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I've seen like really far down. Like,
if you
really?
If you want to look up, you know, the Nitei Gavriel always quotes all these esoteric shitas about every topic that he writes about. So in his sefer on bar mitzvah, he brings shitas that hold that if rove of the tefillin is in the correct place, then it's good.
I gave a shit on this a few years ago.
Oh.
And,
No, Gavalik, yeah.
And, if I remember correctly, I'll find the shit right now, but Rav Kook's first sefer that he ever wrote was on this topic. Familiar with that? Like, when he was still in Europe, he was, like, on this crusade.
Mm-hmm.
He felt it was, like, a very, very big problem. He saw everybody was not showing this. And he wrote this nice contrast for him. He said that it's a huge problem. And he was going all over from one place to the next, but there are another ton of people that have to...
Put their Yeah, so you're right. There are Gedolim pictures where they seem to be wearing the tefillin a little lower.
By the way, but an interesting question, you know, practical rabbinics discussion is, if anybody's interested, I have a sheet on it. Like, I'm happy to send it to you. But it's an interesting. You know, question: how you deal with different Balabatim who you know, and how and when and what way you point it out, and what if they don't listen, and what if they forget.
But, what if it's 12 the wrong place?
Yeah, interesting sensitivities. Sometimes people are just, they're just careless, it gets knocked out of place, it doesn't make a difference with guys down for the helmet. You know, it's a sugi with now, so it's not so much in terms of the film, just how to deal with Balabatim.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
No, I hear. 100%. Yeah, the tefillin could be in the wrong place in terms of the front and the back. So some people have the knot in the back too low. It's really supposed to be on the skull. It's not supposed to be on the neck. The Mishnah Berurah says that as long as it's on a place with hair, it's kosher, even if it lechatchila is supposed to be on the skull. But if it's below a place with hair, then it's for sure no good.
That's pretty low.
Yeah.
That's pretty low down,
right? Yeah.
Hair,
what?
People lose their hair on the back.
Go by the original.
The hair looks too.
But it's also, you feel like the bump. It's really supposed to be centered over like that bump.
There's
a bump. Some shittas hold, it's supposed to be completely on top. But yeah, there's like a little bump on the base of your skull on the back. So it's supposed to be, the kesher is really supposed to be around there.
It's not there?
I don't know.
Like every time I eat my kesher to make it like to make the thing a little smaller, like a week later it's back where it used to be. I don't really understand what the
mitzvah. Well, there are two stretch.
Stretching so quickly.
The ritzuas also have a minimum width according to the accepted shita, which is approximately 1 centimeter. Supposed to be the width of a seora, the length of a seora. I mean, measure the width.
If you stretch, they can really
pretty
narrow.
Yeah. So you should make sure that the whole ritzua is the correct width. If it's tied that way in the knot, because the knot needs to be, obviously it can't maintain the width through the entire knot, but wherever possible, yeah, it should be that. Usually with the ritzua, the standard width of the ritzua nowadays is 15 millimeters, so it gives you some wiggle room. But you should make sure that it's at that. There is a shita that there is no required width of the ritzua, so again, this is something for Baal Batim won't listen, so maybe you can be a little bit happier that they might not be sinning as much as you thought they were.
Would be the Evid problem? How many would be?
Maybe 9 millimeters. Yeah. It's a skill, though, that you should learn how to adjust the ritzua of the shel rosh. Because a lot of people, again, are perfectly willing to change the size if you to make sure the tefillin are in the proper place, if only they would know how. It's extremely easy. It's much easier, by the way, with a square than with the so-called dalet.
But there's two kinds of... There's like the dalet, there's like the... What they call like the regular dalet and the double dalet?
Well, there's one... There's a dalet that's used by... Only Hoicha Mikubalim, maybe some Kloisenberger Chassidim, who mamash has a hole in the middle. The whole knot is this big. It looks like this. You might. It's very likely you've never even seen such a thing. If you go to some shtiebel in Williamsburg, so maybe you'll find it. But that's everybody's masculine. That's not everyone, but that's pretty newfangled. Yeah, just stick with. Yeah, like I said, lechatchila, the regular is plain square, and the dalet one is probably more correct than this one. Yeah.
There's like a dalet that's like the normal dalet that most people have. I also think there's like a dalet that which is relatively easy to extend because the ritzua that comes down.
What, that slides?
Like, yeah, it just kind of like loops up and then down. So all I have to do is get enough leverage in.
Oh, for you it's easy. For most people it's hard.
Okay, but there's another dalet knot.
Yeah.
Where it's like after the it starts with that knot and then it like goes like a second time around on top of itself, which I've seen people with this feeling. I've seen like people tying this knot.
I'm not sure exactly what you're talking about. You can show me afterwards.
Say the square was a problem.
Yeah, but all the Rishonim say that you should have the square. So
is that like one of the two in Hagen?
Yeah, sitting on the Sukkah and Shmini Atzeres. Yeah. So
what did the Rav say?
The Rav said that even if your minag is the square knot, you should switch to the so-called dalet knot. But the problem is that in all the Rishonim, it says do the square knot. So, I mean, this is why we love Rav Soloveitchik, but Lemaisef, it's a choice between al Rishonim, literally, and Rav Soloveitchik. So, I personally would choose al Rishonim, but Rav Schechter doesn't. Rav Schechter knows that really the older knot, the original minag for thousands of years was the square knot, but he says... Someone offered, I think, once to buy him new ritzuas, if on condition that he switched back, switched to the square knot to be more halacha.
What's the generous offer? Nurtzuris?
What? Nurtzuris, yeah.
So for $50, he should go against his Rebbe?
No, go like the Rebbe. Go like the
Rebbe. No, they could go like Al Rishonim. So he showed Rav Shechter, all the Rishonim inside. He showed the Al Rishonim, say the square knot. So he said, no, so you're right. So Taka should have a square knot. So he said, okay, Rebbe, if you actually do it lemaisa, I'll get you Nurtzuris. So Rav Shechter said, okay. So good. So a few weeks he had the square knot. Then he switched back to the dalit. So the guy came back. He said, "Rebbe, I got you new ritzuis. I'll deny that you had the square knot." He said, "I couldn't do it. I couldn't. Every time I saw it, like I felt my Rebbe saying, you know, you can't have the square knot. You have to switch to the dalit." So people who are emotionally connected to Rav Soloveitchik in that way.
The dalit?
What?
Does anybody say the dalit is a problem? I mean, according to those who shown say you should have
the hand. Well. Not explicitly, but if the tzura of the kesher, it's a whole sugya. But if the tzura of the kesher is halacha l'moshe misinai, so I personally, even if you could come up with an argument that a dalit is okay, so I wouldn't play with halacha l'moshe misinai. I'd go with there's very clear evidence that this is what literally Gan Kol Yisrael was doing for thousands of years.
Square.
Literally.
Where does it come? Where did the dalit come from?
The Gemara says that the tzuras on the shel yada looks like a yud, and on the shel rosh it looks like a dalad. So how the square looks like a dalad? So in my approach, again, maybe all different approaches, but my approach is, if you have clear evidence, this is what everyone was doing for thousands of years without any there was no other alternative. So that's what you do, and maybe one day we'll come up with a teretz for why this looks like a dalad, and people do. And suggestions of why it looks like a dalit. Not that you say, it must be that for thousands of years everyone was wrong and that we should make the kesher differently. That's the way I look at halacha, but not everybody looks at it that way. Fine. So, in the kesher shel yad, so another thing people make a very big deal out of is... that the yud, the kesher of the shel yad, has to touch the bias. I have innumerable fathers of high schoolers, new bar mitzvah boys, who learned, the Rebbe said in school, that the kesher of the shel yad has to touch the bias, and they see that it's a little loose, it doesn't really touch the bias, so they're very, very nervous. So the truth is, the Shulchan Aruch does say that, quoting the Zohar. It's one of the few places where the Shulchan Aruch actually literally quotes the Zohar. So it is something we should be makbid on, but it's not as if you're not Yotzei Mitzvah Tillin if your Yud Kesher of the Shel Yad does not touch the bias. And furthermore, the simple understanding really should be that the Kesher doesn't have to touch the Ketzitza, this part itself, but rather touching the Titura should be good enough, even though people like to have it to be makbid that it actually touches the bias, the Ketzitza itself. In order to do that, so if you have a Sephardi or a Hasidisha type of tefillin where you wrap out, so the pulling action of the wrapping out sort of draws the yud to touch with the bias, so normally you have fewer problems if you wrap out. But if you wrap in and you're pulling the kesher away from the bias, so then you have problems. That's why they invented this thing that you tie, usually use a gid because that's what Sofrim have around, but there's no reason it has to be a gid, it's not a halachic thing. That it could be a string or anything, that you tie the kesher to the bias, that when you pull it, it stays connected to the bias. So that's a very very simple repair, but if there are any people who are very nervous about not being Yotzei Mitzvah Tillin because the yud isn't touching the bias, this is not the biggest emergency in Hilchos Tefillin. In terms of checking tefillin and mezuzis, so the Gemara brings different shittas, but the Shulchan Aruch Paskins... That you never have to check tefillin. That if the tefillin were found to be muchzak, they were bought from a reputable source, you never have to check them. The Shulchan Aruch passes this way. Based on the Rambam, based on one sheet in the Gemara. So the even though this is the halacha, nevertheless the poskim nowadays generally recommend that tefillin should be checked from time to time. Why? We'll finish up.
Yeah.
So the reason is because the same you saw that the ink nowadays is much weaker than the ink that they used to use in the times of the Gemara, so it actually flakes much more easily and the letters could become damaged, so therefore the general recommendation is that you should get your tefillin checked a couple years after your bar mitzvah, just to make sure everything is still in order. And then after that, just from time to time, whenever the mood strikes you, every 10, 20, 30 years, whatever. If they're in excellent condition, it could be less frequently. If the sofer notices that there's some flaking already beginning, then it should conceivably be more frequently. Yeah.
Even if you rely on, I mean, the chazaka, but my son, don't we say, like, you're not going to be Yosef if it's puzzle. So you're going to read the Meshachachma, then
it's different.
Like, check every 20 years, it could be like halachically, the Shukhar says you don't
have
that's
a shayla. If Alpidin, you don't have to check, so you were Yotzi the Mitzvah, maybe. It's a whole Dion, I think, if I'm not mistaken.
Right,
different
yeah.
You're
saying,
okay, so
it's the rice.
So check more frequently,
so
okay. Give Sofer more business.
If you found out there was newspapers inside, so Kashub Shad, you were never Yotzi. But if you found out that it was a flake, who says it flaked 10 years ago, last time you checked?
But why not? Like, saying, why not check every year? People do like, you know, 5 years because it ruins it. Like, is there a negative, like, money? And
not really. In good quality tefillin, opening them up the frequently should not damage the quality. No. If you open them up every day, maybe. But if you open them up even 50 times in a lifetime, it shouldn't be. I mean, if you have low quality tefillin, maybe. But it really should not cause damage.
Does most tefillin last people a lifetime? Like, should tefillin last?
In the today's Gassos tefillin, it's very common that tefillin lasts a lifetime. In the times of Gemara, they used to talk about getting new tefillin all the time. They used to replace them because they used to wear out. Nowadays, tefillin don't really wear out. As I mentioned last time, some people update their tefillin because they flipped out and they want to have more chumras than the tefillin that they used to have.
Is it if you keep it out in the sun or you like talking about meetings? Like, is that? Or in, like, in a cold place, or you shower before, and your hair is wet.
Very unlikely it causes problems. Very, very, very unlikely. I get questions, unless it was, I don't know, if it was 110 degrees outside and really humid, and it was mamish on the dashboard of the car, and it was left there for 5 days, and very, very unlikely.
Wow.
Very unlikely.
What could happen? It could go through and the sun could, like, ruin the parchment?
No, just that the intense heat could make it flake more.
Uh-huh.
But normally, unless something, a major, major event happened to the tefillin that would cause a lot of damage, it's very unlikely. If you want to check it, fine, but it's not. Most people, I don't think I ever told someone who said they left their tefillin in a hot or cold car that they should rush to check the tefillin. In general, I discourage people from checking the tefillin because they say, it's about time to get my tefillin checked. I had them checked, it was already 5 years ago. I have to check them again. I usually try to discourage people from checking tefillin. It's usually not necessary most of the time. Again, just from time to time. Mezuzah, so the Gemara says you're supposed to check it twice in 7 years, every 3.5 years. There are poskim that say that if the mezuzah was kept in a very well-preserved area, like indoors, and a lot of times mezuzahs nowadays are wrapped in plastic before they're put in the case, or if they're kept in a waterproof case, or they were written in one of the inks that I prefer. That's some of them are actually waterproof. So the one I mentioned last time, Dila Netzach, is waterproof, so it shouldn't be even subject to water damage. It shouldn't be subject to flaking. So if you have a super well-preserved mezuzah for any of these reasons. So some poskim say that you can check the mezuzah less frequently. So that's just something you can decide for your balabatim, how frequently you should tell them to check mezuzahs. But most people still seem to check every 3.5 years, but it could be that, according to the strict halacha, even that's not necessary. It would just be more infrequent.
I'm sorry, why would you have to check more frequently than tefillin?
Because mezuzahs are subject, at least in the times of the Gemara, where indoors were damp, there was mold, they weren't well preserved. Sometimes the mezuzah was literally just you would dig out a hole in the doorpost and shove the mezuzah in and let it sit there, so it was more subject to deterioration.
But as much as that, you would say only 10 or 20 years for tefillin, I mean, if you keep it in your house.
So I can't give you an exact number for the mezuzah, but
you're suggesting that you would not have to check it before.
Yeah, I think Shlomo Zalman says that. I think Shechter agrees with that. You can decide for yourself. That's a halacha shayla. It's not a safra shayla per se. I can give you information to inform you, but also you could learn if the sofer is not around. So you could learn how to recognize problems with the mezuzah just by looking at it. That if you can see there's obvious flaking, then there's more of a problem. So there are situations where you don't need a trained sofer to check the mezuzah. Okay. I think we've reached the end. Yeah, sure.
All the in terms of the Lucius, all the same rules apply as Tip Trail apply to Mizuza, or the
yep. Mm-hmm.
Thank you very
okay.
much for having
me. Yes. Welcome. Thanks for having me.
We don't have the supplies to answer the question, but you seem to think that the mem was easier to adjust than the Dalit.
Don't call it a mem.
The box.
It's a Dalit. It's a Dalit. They're all Dalits.
Okay, fine, the Dalit.
Yeah.
The square is easier than the L shape.
Yeah. Oh, I like that. Yeah.
I have found that the square is very difficult. So I must be doing something wrong.
Probably.
Okay.
I'll show you.
Can
bring
I
it. Yeah.
Come by sometime.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure.